And we will definitely take a look at it and see how it makes sense to advocate. Okay, moving on to our mental health priority. The City of Portland has consistently supported increased state investment in community mental health and addiction services, and the legislature responded in 2013 legislative session with an 18.4% increase in mental health care funding. This item addresses a gap in the mental health care system by advocating for state funding to build a crisis drop-off center in Portland. This would create a new door into the mental health system so that those suffering from mental health crisis can be appropriately assessed, treated, and connected to community-based care.
So I have some concerns about the way this one is worded, and I want to work with you on that because it kind of implies it's going to be a long-term care facility going from, well, it does say, it says continuum of care from acute care to lower levels of treatment as appropriate. I'm not sure how much the city and the county have been involved in those discussions. And the other issue, the main issue, in my opinion, for mental health care in addition to this is community-based care. So the problem has been that the funding that was promised for community-based care has not materialized. So people get stuck in expensive inpatient and facilities that are not therapeutically the right thing for them. So we need to work more on the language in this.
Well, I think we need to work, I agree with you, and we also need to work with the evolving set of players that have some stake in getting this system working better. The crisis center piece is a piece of it, but there has to be the backdoor services in place for that to be effective. So there's a lot of complexity, as you know, to this issue. So I think simply raising the state commitment to mental health funding generically isn't enough. They have to do some specific things like this in order for the system to work better.
Right. I'm concerned that our current objective only mentions the crisis drop-off center and doesn't mention community-based residential care.
Yeah, okay. I hear you. I think we need to be advocating for both.
The details in here, I'm not sure how much the details matter when it's in the legislature, but you and I need to have some conversations mm-hmm. about exactly what is that going to be and what is the city's role in helping to set it up.
Yep. Good.
Okay, moving on to the next priority on our list, recreational marijuana. This item indicates that Portland will advocate for lifting the preemption on local taxing authority over the emerging recreational marijuana market. The recent legalization of recreational marijuana will require local governments to play a significant role both in ensuring the smooth implementation and reasonable enforcement of the new law. And at least 70 cities, including Portland, have enacted local taxes on recreational marijuana. The state revenue sharing outlined in the new law requires local governments to spend those proceeds on public safety, even though local government responsibilities are much more extensive. Lifting the preemption will ensure that local governments can raise revenue and provide flexible use of those funds for a variety of city services.
A comment on the placement of that. We've got the general topic of lifting preemptions under our policy positions. And personally, I think that lifting the preemption on inclusionary zoning is probably more important than lifting the preemption on taxing marijuana. And actually, from a policy perspective, I think giving local governments the authority to tax alcohol and cigarettes is as important as taxing recreational marijuana, even though there might not be a particular impetus for doing that this session. I was kind of wondering if instead of just calling out recreational marijuana preemption as a priority, if we might say that one of our draft priorities is addressing preemptions generally and then listing them and allowing you guys to be opportunistic about which ones to focus your resources on.
So we traditionally made preemptions a priority for the reasons you've talked about. It gives us some flexibility to determine both play offense and defense on that issue. I think on the recreational marijuana side, one thing that sets that apart from some of the other issues, maybe with the exception of inclusionary zoning, is that because the voters acted this will be the first session where I think there will actually be a pretty robust discussion in the legislature about this topic. And I think it will require a lot of effort on our behalf to put into this issue. And that's sort of why it's flagged as a priority. We're going to have to put a lot of city resources in order to be successful. So I think that's why it is where it is. But creating a preemption section is something that would be pretty easy to do as well.
Can I just offer a qualified support for the suggestion? Because I would support putting the inclusionary zoning piece as a priority, as a freestanding priority, because I think with the governor's support, leadership support, given the dynamics, it's going to happen. I think that's one we want to jump on board early. I've been here long enough to know that we have this catch-all on preemptions, and once upon a time, one of the ones that was on the list was the real property transfer tax. And everyone knew that you weren't going to lift the preemption, and then ultimately the door was slammed when the realtors referred it as a constitutional amendment and got it locked in so we can never discuss it. Just my sense, Steve, is that we're essentially directing Martha and her team to prioritize. It better serves our interest to focus on a couple that we think we can make some progress on and not just ask her to include them all as priorities, because I mean, she'll check that box. She'll raise it and be told that 75% are not going to be taken up this time, but which is why I think they belong on the secondary list. And my own preference would be to elevate inclusionary zoning as something that we strongly support, lifting the preemption, which is a principled issue, which is a question of local control. By lifting the preemption, we would no longer have the dubious distinction of being one of two states in the union, the other being Texas, that has by law prevented local jurisdictions from deciding whether that's a tool they want in their kit. And that's all we're talking about. We're talking about lifting a preemption so that at the local level we can decide whether it's a tool that we want in our kit, and if so, how we'd want to structure it. And I think it actually elevates the prestige of that issue and risk diluting it if we just throw all the preemptions in as a priority.
Actually, that's my highest priority, so I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, I think the other reason to do it that way, I agree, is we want to do this on inclusionary zoning, and we're prepared to act. We might not be prepared to act on some of the others. And we have to decide the question about marijuana. If the legislature is going to stick us with what's in the measure as passed, which is we get this revenue sharing scheme and we have to spend it on public safety, we end up in a place that we really don't want to be. So in those two cases, there's a lever for action in both cases, and we want some change in both cases. So it might be best, even though I agree with you in principle, Steve, to focus on these two, because that's where the activity is going to be this session.
I think we should be directing the city attorney to fight any opposition to the tax that we passed before the measure passed. It seems to me that it was clearly constitutional and within our rights for us to pass that tax. So whether they take it off at the state level or not, ours is good.
Ah, true.
Yeah. So, yes, thank you very much. We'll take your state tax for the law enforcement piece, and we've got our local tax that can help take care of some of the other issues, education and such.
Right. Yeah, true.
So Martha, just to close the loop on this,
I'm not a lawyer, actually,
based on what you've heard, which seems to be consensus on the council, do we put inclusionary zoning and specifically lifting the preemption as a priority or as an initiative?
Oh, I think we should put it as a priority.
Yeah, what I'm hearing from council at this point is that we'll elevate inclusionary zoning from where it is as a draft policy position to make it a priority and lead with that and the recreational marijuana preemption as the city's two lead preemptions for the session.
Thank you.
Okay.
So moving on to our next priority, support for rural communities. Realizing that the health and vitality of urban and rural communities are intertwined. Portland has a continuing tradition of working with its rural partners on issues that impact rural communities. This session, we're looking at potentially supporting the expansion of Oregon State University's statewide public service programs, as well as supporting a tax credit that would help rehabilitate rural main streets and have a specific set aside for rural communities.
So in addition to the ones you have listed here, when we get into the next page on transportation funding, it turns out that some of the highways where we don't have crash barriers are in rural communities, so I think it would be helpful to add that to this part of the agenda because we need to help rural legislatures understand that we want their roads to be safe too.
Agree with that. And there's also the orphan highways issue subsumed in the state transportation discussion that nevertheless is important to a lot of smaller communities around the state. They want, some of them want the option to do what we want to do with Powell and Division, Powell and 82nd and so on. Some of them don't. Some of them are happy to have ODOT maintaining their main street because they don't have the money. But there are others who say, we'd like to have control of this street. So that's another issue where we can build some common ground with the rest of the state, I think.
One question I have about this is, this one seems very broad and thematic. And I realize that it's something that, in theory, everyone subscribes to. The question is, what are the specific initiatives that drive it? And I think what sometimes is obscured is that we have lots of other immediate ways we can support rural communities as a city without waiting for SALA. For example, we're a net exporter of dollars through the tax credit for the arts. The Oregon Cultural Trust is... lion's share of its money comes from Portland. That money is distributed statewide. So that is a way we support arts and culture in rural communities. We take our biomass from our treatment facility and we ship it to rural Oregon, and it's used, you know, for fertilizer to grow crops. I'm hoping that with Commissioner Saltzman's focus on bringing the cost of per unit of housing down on affordable housing, that we make a big, big pitch towards modular housing. And one of the virtues of modular housing is that in rural communities that are shifting from a timber-based economy to something else, there are communities that could actually manufacture the modular housing, ship it to us, and we could, in doing so, we could help subsidize and support the local economy. We've done that once or twice here in Portland where we bought the modular housing and we shipped. It's a very specific way that we can. I think we did it with biodiesel. So I appreciate the broad thematics, and I guess this is sort of League of Cities wants this in as a values proposition. But I would challenge us as a city to actually look specifically at ways we can help promote rural economies through things that we don't need the legislature support to do. And think about maybe a second agenda of things we can come back to every year and say, what are a few things that we can do that are actually going to further the goal, the laudable goal of this. But are more concrete in terms of things we have some control over.
I think that's good stuff. We should always be looking for ways that we can be doing things to support rural Oregon. And I think these are good initiatives. I guess one of the things I was going to raise as a possible addition is, I know there's been talks about the Umatilla River Basin, and it seems like the talks are going well in terms of some sort of a legislative water rights fix that would keep more Columbia River water in the river for fish, but also allow irrigators to access more water. And it sounds like the tribes, the irrigators, local governments are all happy in the governor's office. So it might be something we can pile on, put it in our agenda, and
sure.
Unless I'm missing something on
no,
this.
No, yeah. I don't think so. In fact, we have certainly prioritized different phases of their project in the past as part of the rural agenda. What we'll do between now and when we bring an agenda back is talk to some of the folks who have been involved in that process, and if it seems like something we'll bring back to you, you want to support, we'll include it in the rural agenda.
So the final draft priority is for transportation, maintenance, and safety, and we've already touched on a couple of issues here. This priority is very broad, and I guess I'll just start by saying that it's an open question as to whether or not there will be a transportation package in 2015. Portland has been working as part of a diverse stakeholder group on a comprehensive transportation package. The group has developed a straw man proposal. A couple of notable portions of that straw man would be indexing the gas tax. There's also a 1 cent gas tax increase to create a pilot program for the transfer of orphan highways, funding Connect Oregon 6, and a few other details. Separate and apart from that process, the city's been collaborating with the Oregon Department of Transportation on state highway improvements, namely around median crash barriers. Also, we're waiting on ODOT's revisited study of studded tires to come out. We'll review that study. It should be out shortly, and then support cost recoupment for the disproportionate wear and tear that studded tires cause on our roads.
Elizabeth, I apologize for not having flagged this before today, but I would suggest a language change in the studded tires sentence to support proposals to address disproportionate wear from studded tires, including authorization for local action. So again, support proposals to address disproportionate wear from studded tires, including authorizations for local action, because this is something I discuss with literally every legislator I see, and the proposal that seems most likely to attract some support is for the legislature to say that counties can either tax or prohibit studded tires, which would raise the possibility that Multnomah, we could convince Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas to join in doing something, which would mean that the legislature wouldn't have to worry about Bend, Baker, et cetera. And if a car from Bend with studded tires drove through, well, they could do that. But the majority of the cars on our roads, obviously, are from the Tri-County area. So I think that that might actually have a shot. So I just support changing the language to reflect what we think has the best shot.
Happy to do that.
And I don't want the crash barriers thing to get lost should there not be a transportation omnibus bill. And I also would have requested an amendment to that second bullet and just delete the collaboration with the Oregon Department of Transportation, because presumably we're going to try to collaborate with them on all of these, and our agenda is not necessarily dependent on whether they support it as well. And then I would say enact policies and funding, not just promote, because all of the others are actual bills in the legislature that I would hope there'll be a specific bill on this one.
And thank you for that, Commissioner. Thank you for the clarification. We will make sure that the language we bring back, make sure that we have the flexibility to work on that issue outside of a broader transportation package.
Okay. With that, I'll turn it over to Andy to start walking through our initiatives.
Okay, so starting at the top of the list, also in alphabetical order, the first initiative on the list is the Children's Service District. This item indicates that the City of Portland will introduce legislation to add Children's Service District to the list of permissible special districts allowed under state law. And this would allow communities across the state the chance to create permanent funding sources to support programs for children and families.
Just on that one, I told Commissioner Saltzman, I am concerned about the compression impact. I mean, I think the impact on the city is $1.9 million a year, which is obviously a small fraction of our budget, but it's also something like the equivalent of 15 Buckman pools. So I do have a concern about putting that in there. We haven't figured out where the money would come from on our side.
And I respect the concerns I'm sure all of you have about the impacts of compression from this type of proposal. We're really just trying to take a baby step that would lead at some point to voters, county voters, having the option of making a decision to create such a service district. And, you know, any county throughout the state would have this option. But yeah, and, you know, we've done a compression analysis. I've shared it with you, and you know, I can't deny that there aren't compression impacts, but I also would say that this is a 3 to 4 year process before it's even going to reach any kind of a decision point by voters. And from everything we hear from our economists, the compression picture is improving each year. We should knock on wood, but I certainly respect that concern. We're just asking for permission to sort of begin the baby steps of even getting to the point of asking voters to make such a decision.
I just a comment about something Steve just mentioned. Beginning of last year, had to close a budget deficit of which approximately 40 to 45% was a result of the library district, which, to my knowledge, virtually everyone in this panel supported, some enthusiastically. But the net effect of that was it created a hole. And that was an interesting experience, because when we flagged the issue of compression and impact, We had some friends at the county who said it was rather galling for us to mention that since we've been taking money out of their pockets through urban renewal for a long time. I appreciate the politics of that, but I also think it raised for me another question, which is we look at, sometimes we back into these things rather than addressing them through the front door, and this is what I mean by that. If the county had come to us and said through the front door, would you like to appropriate $8 to $10 million a year for libraries? What would have been the council's position on that? Would it have made the mayor's proposed budget? Would it have gone ahead of parks and public safety? No. But because it was framed differently, do you love your libraries? Do you want to put them on a solid footing? And oh, by the way, there's a cost that everyone has to incur. It was framed differently, adopted by the voters. We love our library system, but it had a huge impact. And I would say respectfully that I think in some ways we're putting the cart before the horse on this one too, because I think a question that we might want to ask is, regardless of whether this district's created or whether children's funding shifts to the county, as is would be contemplated under this long term, if Commissioner Saltzman came to the council and said, I'd like to request $2 million of ongoing money every year for children's program, is that a council priority? And I think we have to have that tough conversation before we set up a dynamic where we are inexorably moving to a situation where the money's going to come out of our budget for a good and laudable purpose, but not for a purpose that we have debated as being a priority ahead of other general fund requests. And I guess my question for you and for your team is, if this is an initiative, how much time and energy does this consume? And how much pushback do you anticipate from special districts who have become particularly, it seems to me, sensitive to movements like this, which end up then taking money out of their pockets as well?
I guess I would view myself as being the principal proponent for this down in Salem, certainly with the support of the government relations team, which is indispensable to getting the types of meetings. I mean, we've had meetings already in September during the legislative days with legislators of both parties, and fairly favorable response to the notion of this is in essence a local control issue. We're asking for permission to ask voters to create this, to give counties that authority. So I think I view myself as being the principal shoe leather down there. The Special Districts Association at first blanch has said they're opposed to this. I guess I wouldn't expect anything else when you have lobbyists who are paid to do things and they're not doing much during legislative day sessions. It's easy for them to just sort of latch onto something and say we're against it. I don't think that's by any means the last word on this. I mean, it is it is subject to legislative process, and we have supporters down there, and we have, I think, many legislators who view this favorably from a local control perspective as well. Why not give counties this authority?
Dan, I have a question about conversations you may have had with Chair Kafoury, Chair Kafoury and her team. My understanding of the long-term vision would be to create a countywide district and then have this program migrate to the county and ultimately be administered. And that makes sense to me because the children's program fall more closely within their set of sort of charter-based responsibilities. Obviously, we have a big stake in children, but it's centrally framed for them. Has Chair Kafoury indicated to you a willingness to, hold other jurisdictions harmless for any compression?
I don't have any such specific commitment from her. She is supportive of advancing this concept or seeing if we can advance this concept in Salem. And I think the reason to migrate it to the county is not only because maybe it's a better fit, but the children's levy right now is only serving 80% of the children in Multnomah County. And we all know that the areas of high poverty are often the areas that are outside of the city. So it's a matter of equity too, I think, is to provide a shot for these kids, these 20% of the kids that don't live in city limits, to also have access to the proven programs that help make children safe and successful that the children's levy does.
Have they indicated to you that they intend to make this either a priority or a key initiative in their legislative agenda, since it will ultimately be a program that they administer?
Well, like I said, Chair Kafoury has indicated to me she wants to see us give this a shot in Salem. I guess that's the best commitment I have from her at this point. And it's still, you know, the question of whether this actually gets to county voters is still, as I said, you know, probably a 2 or 3 year process.
So the Children's Fund has helped hundreds of thousands of children over the time that you've led the work, and over the course of the recession has probably made a huge difference, maybe even a life and death difference for children and families. The concern I have with this is that it doesn't increase funding overall. It slices the pie differently, and it's not statewide. And I would like to see this initiative transformed into something which, for example, would say if there's going to be a personal kicker, that it goes to funding children's services, early childhood education, and hunger, addressing that statewide. I bet you that would pass statewide, because children in Harney County need these services just as much as those in Multnomah County, and I see this as only fixing our piece at the expense of other things which would not be on the ballot. You know, as Commissioner Fish says, when we approved the library district, it didn't say, would you like to fund our libraries? Oh, and by the way, that's going to cut into your parks. We already have the authority to form a parks district, and I can't in good conscience propose one because it, like I said, it doesn't increase the slice of the size of the pie. It just slices it differently. So what if we change this into something that would press for having this statewide?
Well, I'm certainly not opposed to anything statewide direction of resources to help kids, but I guess I would respond that, you know, this is a step that I feel is a tractable step, and I feel, you know, taking on a more global perspective, you know, our voice about our ultimate voice about what happens with the personal kicker is you know, going to be one of many. Whereas I think with this particular legislation, we can have some impact, and this does give Harney County residents, if this passes, this gives them the same ability to ask their voters to form a higher priority for investing in children, just like it does voters in Multnomah County. So it's permissive for every county in the state.
But then there's
it's not the grand statewide solution, but it's maybe a way of getting there and giving local voters a chance to say we want to make children a higher priority.
So it does. The question, the comment that Mena just made, though, raises another interesting conundrum, which is you have been the passionate champion for children on this council. In fact, because of your leadership, it was just renewed for another, whatever, 4 or 5 years. So you've put it on solid footing, and you're to be congratulated for that. But to say that we should create a district and a permanent source of funding, which does, in effect, just slice the bread differently and creates winners and losers in terms of funding because of our dysfunctional tax system, does strike me as being somewhat out of sequence, because each of us might have a view about what that next district should be if we thought that was the only way to achieve our goals. A parks district, a district for housing, a district for a number of public safety, all kinds of funding. We're forced to look at these districts because we don't have adequate revenue. But the net effect of the district is it's there are winners and losers, and special districts and local government have money come out of their general fund sort of magically. And yes, laudable that we put on solid footing children's programs, but this council hasn't even begun the conversation of where children, parks, public safety, housing, homelessness, and other things rank. How can we possibly prioritize this without deciding what our as a body priorities are, particularly where you've done such a good job providing stable funding for the next however many years that the voters have given you, 4 or 5 years, which is a tremendous accomplishment?
Well, I think I would respond that, you know, each one of us has our own personal priorities, and I think, you know, I'm asking for the ability to pursue this priority, and I'm hoping that, you know, while we haven't had an exhaustive discussion about where children rank in our priorities, I think it's pretty evident they do rank pretty high on our priorities. We spend a lot of time and effort around dealing with young people who are, you know, in the correctional system or on the verge of being in the correctional system. You know, we care a lot about pre-K education opportunities. We care a lot about child abuse. So I think, you know, these things run throughout all of our priorities, and this is simply, you know, I'm asking to be afforded the opportunity to pursue this opportunity, which I believe, you know, won't be nowhere near the scale of a library district if it gets to a vote. I mean, it's not going to be anywhere as large as library district. You know, right now, the children's levy is about $10 million a year. If it were to go countywide, I would imagine it being $20 million a year. So it's not nowhere near on the scale of the compression impacts. So yeah, I mean, I think there's, I think we, if you go through our legislative agenda, I think you'll find priorities each one of us bring to it from a personal perspective, and that's, this is one I'm bringing from a personal perspective, and I'm asking for your support to be able to run with us.
So that actually raises an interesting challenge, which again, like this discussion, we haven't brought out into daylight in the 6 years that I've been on the council, and that is the influence that each of us has as individuals, and sometimes as individual citizens, let alone as elected officials, and how we work with the legislature as a body versus having priorities that aren't on the list. And so I would certainly be comfortable with you doing what you said in terms of as a something that, you would could do as a leader going down to the legislature. But having it on the city's agenda presupposes that we've had that discussion that we all think it's a good, that we would be 100% behind it. And so I do think that one doesn't lose one's rights as an individual or a citizen or one's rights as an individual commissioner by being a part of a five-member body. It's a question of whether you're speaking for all of the rest of us.
So if I may interject just briefly, I do think that one of the very difficult exercises that this council needs to do is really frame up a short prioritized list of legislative priorities. And while in principle I agree that nobody gives up, as Commissioner Fritz said, personal rights of the First Amendment, it gets very confusing for legislators to make that distinction and members of our legislative delegation. It would be like an independently elected official coming to you asking you to put something in the city's budget without the full support of their entity. And I think as we look forward to speaking with one voice in Salem, it's one of the greatest challenges I think this council has is figuring out what are those key items when the messaging starts to be different coming from one entity. It's difficult for our delegation to understand what is the city's priority. And that's why I think we're going through this exercise now. So my words of advice is between now and January, we come up with what is that short list of asks we want to make of our legislative delegation. And my office and all of us here are here to help each of you in the city as a whole be successful with that list. But it really is important that we, as a city, speak with one voice when we're talking with the state of Oregon. Otherwise, it can get really confusing for them.
Okay, thank you. Let's go ahead and move on then.
The next item on our list of draft initiatives is fixed voter radar. This legislation would provide the City of Portland with authority to use fixed voter radar cameras on its high crash corridors. These corridors are only 4% of Portland's arterials, but they account for 66% of pedestrian deaths. It's an enforcement tool that would be used to reduce speeds and dangerous crashes on our roadways.
Expect
we can't do that now. We can't.
Yeah. We expect a lot of pushback on this now in this legislative's composition.
Yes. No, I think that the anytime you talk about the city getting more authority either to do things like set speed limits or increase enforcement, I think members of the state legislature have a pretty strong opinion about that and will potentially go up against organizations, truckers, AAA, who don't want to see more speed enforcement, or at least that being the way. So I think it's going to be a big lift, but one that we're working with both Portland Bureau of Transportation and the Portland Police Bureau to figure out if there's a way we can do this where we can actually get a smoother path going through the legislature.
I mean, this is something that I think is worth shedding, some blood, sweat, and tears over, because this is lives in the bank. I mean, this is, we cannot have our police everywhere. I mean, a traffic division is small enough as it is. And if we had these cameras on, 82nd, 122nd, Powell Division, Burnside, Barber, Sandy, Foster, Marine Drive, and Beaverton Hillsdale Highway, we would save lives. Initially, we would make money, but then people would start complying and we would save lives, which is more important.
Steve, is it possible to get some updated numbers year in from PBOT on the various issues that are involved here? I have to say that since I switched to carpooling, walking, and buses, I've become much more acutely aware of how pervasive I think the behavior on the highways is, and the roadways, our roads, is approaching a level of civil disobedience. I mean, and I dodging cars. That there seems to be a number of motorists under the assumption that a yellow light means accelerate through the intersection. There's an alarming number of bicyclists who don't believe a red light applies to them. I'm not even talking about a rolling stop. I'm talking about the route that I carpool in the morning with my wife. No one stops. And that's fine, I suppose, if you really think that you're so skilled at navigating intersections that you can anticipate that you've got total peripheral vision and you've got it covered. I think it's harder when you've got headphones on and you've got one hand on the bike and you don't have a helmet. I think you're just increasing the risk. I find it, since I walk from Burnside to the office almost every morning now when I get dropped off, I'm just struck by, again, at each intersection, how dangerous it is. And I'm pretty self-reliant, but if I had a mobility issue or something else, I'd be worried. And I just wonder whether we're losing something on our roads. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the huge jump in congestion that we're dealing with, because there seems to be more cars on the road, more congestion, longer hours, frustration or whatever. But we're reaching a point where I think it's becoming there's an acute problem. And I just, I actually occasionally stop people and just say, you know, hi, could you slow down? Or could, that's a red light, you know, and it's for your safety, not just mine. But I think the more ways we elevate our enforcement, the better, because I think some people have a very odd idea about the rules of the road right now, and they're putting a lot of people at risk.
Commissioner, what Gabe and Mark are here, and they'll be happy to share all the statistics that we have related to traffic safety. But as Elizabeth said, 66% of our pedestrian fatalities, 58% of our serious pedestrian injuries occur on just these 10 corridors. So those would be the primary focus of having the fixed cameras.
I've been active on this issue in a while, so I need a grounding, and that is our primary problem philosophical objection to this by legislators, or is our primary problem opposition from interest groups?
I would suggest that it's both, and they're somewhat one in the same. The more people who are going to complain about Portland having more speed cameras are going to be talking to key members of the transportation committees on both sides. What we've seen the legislature do in the last couple of sessions is take larger concepts related to speed and safety. ODOT had a broader bill that got narrowed, and then show that with a pilot program, you can be successful, you can show results. And sometimes in the legislature, it is that incremental approach that is required to move the authority more back toward the city. So I think that's something that we would expect, is we might go in with a broader proposal, and then we will work with members and stakeholders to try to figure out how we can get to at least enough consensus that we can move a bill in the coming session.
So we are allowed to do fixed radar without the photo enforcement attached to it.
We're allowed to have manned vans with people in them. We're not allowed to have fixed, unmanned, unpersoned photo radar cameras.
Right, but we're allowed to have fixed radar. There's one outside of a Garden Home Village on Multnomah. There's one, I think there's now one on Foster and some other places on Willamette Boulevard where there's a steep corner and it, you know, it says speed limit 20, you're going 25. And that is pretty darn effective, especially, in fact, in some ways I believe that's more effective than if I don't happen to know that there's a photo radar there, I'm going to get the ticket and that will change my behavior for the next time. But if I don't go that way very often, I guess what I'm getting at is that there's we need transportation funding to put more of those in. I'm wondering what's the statistics in terms of whether those make things more safe too.
Right, and I think you answered the question I was jumping up here to answer, which was the difference between radar vans and the speed reader boards. We can share more data with you on the speed reader boards. The basic summary of the data is initially they provide a good decline in speeds, but without additional enforcement, people figure out after a while, unless they're in like a corner or something else, that there's, you know, maybe not as much of a reason to slow down. So I think it is an important part of our toolkit, and we'll definitely share some more information with you on both those tools.
There's a speed reading board, for example, over by Legacy Emanuel Hospital that, as you're coming along, tells you your speed. Now, and I'm guessing a lot of people disregard it, so could it be followed up with a rude message to slow down? Followed up with your name in it? Could they do a quick check of the computer system? And
And then red light cameras, are we restricted in their use?
And again, that would be another good example of where with red light cameras, you don't need an officer present.
Right.
Those cameras actually can do speed enforcement as well as red light camera enforcement. But right now, we don't have the authority from the state to use that technology to do the speed enforcement.
But we're not limited by state law on red light cameras, right?
Right.
Use those wherever we see fit, no limitation.
Okay. Generally, right.
Other than practical and budgetary, right?
Right.
Okay.
This is anecdotal, but on the speed reader boards, my recollection is when I took a tour of Foster Road, I forget where it is, there is one of those speed reader boards, and the residents I was walking with said, yeah, we put that up, and people are still speeding.
Right. Yeah, without enforcement, behavior won't stay changed for long.
Yeah. The other message I think we should make clear that people understand is with photo radar vans, there are limits of where we can put those based on some language in statute. With red light cameras, we have more flexibility.
Could you remind us, what's the current fee for driving with a cell phone, and how much of the fine comes back to Portland?
Gabe, can you help me out?
And just for those watching at home, we have a parade of experts from the Portland Bureau of Transportation. First we had Mark Lear, and now it's Gabe Graff.
Thank you.
Hi, Gabe Graff. So I'm not familiar with the exact fine amount for distracted driving. For a speeding citation, the presumptive fine is $260, up thereabouts.
And how much of that do we get?
We get a sliver of it, and it goes into the traffic safety account. It's split amongst Multnomah County court system, and there's lots of other jurisdictions and agencies and priorities get pieces of that fund. It's a percentage. It's a small percentage. I think the traffic safety account gets roughly $400,000 a year that funds programs like high crash corridors and safe routes to school.
Okay. I take it we've decided that the likelihood of ever being able to have a municipal court to adjudicate our own fines and fees locally is next to nil.
Might be a future legislative agenda item.
I'm not proposing it today.
And I might just suggest, in the interest of time, we've got about four more initiatives to go through, and then we want to make sure we leave time for any other questions you may have. I think we are back to Andy on the next initiative.
Okay, the next initiative on the list is Minority and Women-Owned Business Enterprise Contracting Integrity. The current law prevents the city from effectively enforcing minority and women-owned business enterprise program requirements. The city has received a number of complaints that state-certified firms are accessing work on city-funded projects and then passing that work on to non-certified firms to actually do the work. This legislation would give local contracting agencies the ability to take meaningful enforcement action against certified firms that engage in prohibited or fraudulent conduct on government-funded projects. Next item on the list is on-body cameras for police officers. Current law presents a barrier to local law enforcement agencies to implement the use of on-body cameras by police officers. This item addresses those barriers with legislation that provides the same exemption to state eavesdropping laws that exist for dashboard cameras, and requests that the footage of those cameras be exempt from public record laws in order to protect the privacy of citizens, sensitive police investigations, and legal proceedings.
You know, we've been talking a lot about on-body cameras lately, and what keeps running through my mind is, what do you do with all that horrendous footage that's going to emerge? So this would provide that exemption from public records. I know that's a big lift. Does it seem doable?
Well, I think that there's a tremendous amount of momentum nationally around moving forward with on-body cameras for police officers. And I think that the public records issue presents a significant challenge for not only the administration of the program, because there's so much data that's being collected and that is extremely sensitive. It can capture people at their weakest and worst moments, potentially in domestic violence situations, inside of people's homes and other things, that the administrative requirements to go through all that footage and redact it are nearly impossible. And in some jurisdictions around the country, we've seen them just put their hands up and say, we just can't do it. The requests are too massive to fill. That's the reason that a public records exemption is necessary, and it is an administrative issue, and it's also a privacy issue for citizens.
And I just want to add to Andy's comments. I do think it's a big lift. I think there's going to be a robust conversation around the competing public policy concerns, and I think that will probably be the most challenging issue.
But your comments about the catching people at their worst reminds me of our previous efforts to get 911 calls off of public records requests. Is there any likelihood that we could move forward with that again or try again this year?
I think it's an issue that we know has been citizen-driven, and then there was a session where we put it on the city's agenda and took a run at it and weren't ultimately successful. I think we would need to go about finding a new champion. The champion for the last bill was Representative Greg Matthews, who has since retired. And so my sense of that issue is it may take some grassroots work to get that ready for a future legislative session, but I think it's certainly an important issue that we know that there are members of this community who really care about, but I think there's going to need to be some legwork done to make it ripe for introducing in a future session.
But here we're talking about accountability, privacy, how we balance competing values. I mean, it's a very important discussion. It makes you wonder, those terrible reality TV shows where there's actually a camera crew in the cruiser and talk about catching people at their worst moments, and they are, after all, innocent. I mean, they're people pre-charged or charged, but innocent until proven guilty. Do places like Florida just have different laws that have taken the privacy piece out of the equation?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer about to what extent, who needs to sign releases in certain states versus what information is publicly available. I'm not sure, but I think that's something we could look into.
Next on the list is Reconnect Forest Park. Forest Park is one of the largest urban natural areas in the country, but it doesn't have a recognizable entry point. The Portland Parks Bureau has already acquired property, and this draft initiative would seek funds for a feasibility study to redevelop a site into a trailhead and welcome center. And then ending on a sunny note,
Naming the entrance after a certain state legislator? Okay.
Seismic retrofit financing. We know with the Cascadia subduction zone, it's not so much a question of if, but when. And here in the city, we have over 1,000 unreinforced masonry buildings. These structures are a danger to folks both inside and outside of them in the event of a major seismic quake. And this draft initiative would authorize local governments and private lenders to work together to provide loans for seismic retrofits.
So that is
in the governor's recommended budget, there was $70 million allocated for seismic retrofits of schools and $30 million for seismic retrofits of emergency services buildings.
So that's just a high-level overview of the top items in the state agenda. I'm happy to answer any additional questions at this point.
I guess minimum wage at the state level. I see we have something in here about supporting a state increase, but what about lifting the local preemption, or lifting the preemption on local government's ability to establish a minimum wage?
In the preemption section in the draft agenda, which I don't have a page number in front of me, it is on 29. So we have a piece in the preemption section that calls out minimum wage as a preemption the city would support lifting. So there's basically two different places in the agenda where you see discussion of minimum wage. One piece is raising the statewide, and another is specifically in the preemption section calling out that being something that the city ultimately would support lifting.
Have questions about or that we topics that we haven't covered that we ought to have on the list?
I have a couple of possible additions. One is to seek a change to the state statute that prohibits local governments from applying an income tax to certain public retirement income. Mm-hmm. There's specifically with regard to PERS, there's some question as to the legislature's legal ability to allow, consistent with various contract arguments, to allow local governments to apply an income tax, I think, to Tier 1 PERS recipients, but I'm not sure that there's a strong case on post-Tier 1 recipients, and I'm not even totally sure how strong the case is on Tier 1. And obviously, we have been going through the process of contemplating a local income tax, and one of the arguments against it is, well, it doesn't apply to PERS recipients, and I don't really understand why we have this strange barrier towards taxing a certain type of income, and this is something that I've floated with a couple of legislators, and people have not laughed in my face, actually, despite the fact that we know the legislature as a whole is probably unlikely to undertake any big PERS reform in the near future. So that's one thing. Another thing is I'd like to have some statement about the legislature supporting efforts to maximize revenue for public schools, including, for example, ensuring that the lottery is not overpaying its video lottery contractors. This is an issue I've been engaged in since 1999. The last study of how much it costs a video poker parlor to have video poker, which was in 2004, shows that anybody who makes over $11,000 a year is making a profit, and the average tavern gets $77,000 a year. I spent a lot of time dealing with state issues, and this was the most dramatic example of actual wasted abuse that I saw. I had a conversation with the head of the lottery recently who indicated that he was not particularly interested in revisiting the commission rates. The contracts are due to expire this next year, so it is timely. In the past, there have been some legislators, including Carolyn Tomei and Ginny Burdick, who have expressed an interest in the legislature at least directing the lottery to undertake a study of the actual costs of providing video lottery by the retailers to ensure that they're not getting an exorbitant profit. So I'd like to have some reference to that at some point in our agenda.
And Martha, apropos of that, could you give us at some point just a little background on how we got to this situation where PERS benefits are not taxed? I'm reminded that there's always a story around PERS, and I'm reminded that, for example, in the not-too-distant past, there was some criticism about lavish retirement benefits for certain classes of public employees. And one of the details that got omitted from the discussion was that for years, certain classes of public employees had not gotten much in the way of raises or had foregone raises, and the state preferred to give them a bump in their pension because it's a less expensive benefit. A dollar of wages requires you to, to build in statutory taxes and benefits above the dollar. A dollar of pension contribution is simply a dollar. So there was a lot of horse trading where people went without raises to get, maybe a little more in their pension. And I'd just be interested in knowing, not necessarily the legal landscape, but how we got to this situation that they are in fact not taxable. There's probably a good story, and I would be interested in knowing what it is.
Sure, we're happy to look into it, and I do think the city attorney has actually done some work on the history and looking at some of the legal issues. So we'd be happy to work with your offices in the next few weeks and provide that information.
Okay, so as we get ready to wrap up, so what you want us to be able to do at the January meeting is to clearly articulate the top priorities in both cases.
So what we will ask, and we'll take all the comments that you've given us and the guidance you've given us today, thank you very much for that, is between now and then, we will work with each of your offices on coming up with those prioritized lists and making some of these key changes. And to the extent we're vetting some new issues, we'll just accelerate the process. So by the time we bring something to you in January, it will be as close as we think is a consensus agenda for this council.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Anything else before we conclude this? Thanks very much to the whole team. Appreciate you all. And look forward to the next phase of the process. I think it's going to be a very important legislative session and a very interesting session of Congress.
Absolutely. And I just also do want to acknowledge the work of my entire office, some of whom you've seen on camera today, but everyone has really worked really hard to get to where we are. And we're also just really appreciative of your leadership at the council level and level of engagement in this legislative agendas. So thank you.
Thank you.